Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Ha Jin, author of A Free Life, in conversation with author Seth Faison. In this new novel by the National Book Award-winning author of Waiting, an émigré Chinese writer opens a restaurant in Atlanta in a daunting attempt to find his voice as a poet, support his family, and realize the American dream. This program was originally produced on November 14, 2007. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Please welcome Ha Jin and Seth Faison to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thanks for coming tonight. why don't we start? Sorry, I got a parched throat reading backstage. We were talking too fast. Please start by telling us how you came to write this book.
The book was conceived long ago in the winter of 1992. And a friend of mine, Jennifer Rose, who is a poet, was the managing editor of the Agony Review at Boston University. One day she showed me a book of poems given to her by a restaurant owner who was a recent Hong Kong immigrant. And he self-published the book, and apparently the guy had been trying very hard to become an artist. At the same time, he was also running a very small restaurant attached to a supermarket. So I was very touched by the book. And at the time, I thought this would be a good idea for a novel. But I also knew that I was not equipped for such a project. I would have to wait to live through the immigrant life to understand the complexities and nuances of the experience. So not until the year 2000, I began to work on the first draft of this novel. But again, that was kind of under pressure because I received a Guggenheim Fellowship that required me to write something. So I had to write some pages and to report back to them. That's how it came, the first draft came into existence.
Do you like to write under pressure?
I used to because when I took my first job, teaching job at Emory University as an assistant professor teaching poetry writing. So the pressure was very, very intense because I had to publish in order to get through the fourth year review and then the 10-year review. And so I had a terrible time getting my second book accepted. Just couldn't. That's why I kept writing and sending out manuscripts. But for 6 years, 7 years, between 1990 and 1996, I didn't publish anything. But some manuscripts accumulated. That's why I gave people the impression that I was very prolific and wrote very fast. In fact, that was not true. For a long period, basically, I just couldn't publish at all. That made me work harder because it was my livelihood to keep the job, and I had to keep trying.
The books probably that many of you have read were based in China, and I read somewhere once an interview you gave that you wanted to get to the point where you were writing about events and people based in the United States, and
yes,
that we're going to do that from now on. Do you think of your novels as over there or over here, or are they just individual stories that happen to be in one place or another?
Both, I would say, because publicly I have said several times I will not write about contemporary China anymore. I will not write about contemporary China anymore. And that's why a book like War Trash was set in outside China as a step, transitional step toward the United States. But doesn't mean I won't write about other periods of China, like Asian time or even modern time. So in that sense, there might be individual projects, individual books that can be set in China in a different period, or maybe, for instance, a missionary or some other, just the, as example. But contemporary China, since I have not been back to China, and I don't have the physical sense of that place, but I always keep reading news, so I'm informed about what was going on there. But the physical sense of the place, I don't have it anymore. Also, I think for me, the American experience is closer to my heart. I said this many times, I'm an immigrant. So for me, the immigrant experience is more personal, closer to my heart, and more intimate. So I can write better in that sense about such a subject.
Well, I'd like to encourage you to keep an open mind on that.
Sure, okay.
I trust you as a writer about China, even if it doesn't have to be about, you know, what's going on in 2007. One of the reviews I read of War Trash actually said, this reads like a, you know, memoir, like a historical memoir of someone who was a prisoner during the Korean War, and I felt the same way when I was reading that book. And you clearly have the ability to, as a novelist, to sketch out a setting and a place and time and a circumstance and let the story unfold.
You know, there are a lot of things in that book. You know, I had a lot of advantages and really personal. It's not just from paper or research. For instance, in my first year in the Chinese Liberation Army, for the first half year, we stayed on the borderline between China and the former Soviet Union. And
I have to interrupt. You joined the army at age 14, is that right?
Yeah. But
not an ordinary soldier.
But we didn't have our own barracks, so we live in a Korean village. You know, China, inside China, Yanbian, there are six Korean towns.
On the border.
Yeah. So we live for half a year in a Korean village. That really gave me the physical sense of the place and the people, in the language, the customs. And so I had some firsthand experience. And also when we travel, we travel along the Tumen River. So I saw the landscape across the river. It's exactly the same as the Dongbei, the northeastern China, the same kind of landscape. This gave me a lot of confidence when I describe the people and the place and the land, small things, even plants, animals. So that kind of confidence from personal experience. So research itself may not do everything.
Clearly, one of the remarkable things about you as a writer is that you are writing in English, a language that you only learned as an adult, mm-hmm. And yet you are an amazing stylist. And as somebody who struggled very hard to learn Chinese, and I spent many years, and I was really quite proud of myself that I could read enough Chinese to read a newspaper. But reading a novel, I read a few, but it was very tough. But the idea of writing was just beyond the pale for me. So I'm both greatly admiring, extremely impressed, very jealous, but really in awe of both your bravery and your talent to do this.
No, it's talk about that. No, thank you. It's not, as you said, it's not, I think pressure was always a part of my life. And I think to put this in historical perspective, we can see that the English language is a unique language. It has within it, it has a grand tradition in the prose established by non-native speakers such as Conrad and Nabokov. You know, they were not really normal people in the daily life. They, for instance, Nabokov.
Anybody read Lolita?
Nabokov always wrote his lectures. Basically, he would not give interview. He would always write his interviews, and. But once he's on was on the paper, he was brilliant, really a master. So there was a tradition there. In fact, after the Tiananmen massacres, I decided to immigrate. It took me a year to decide to write English because for me, it
was only one.
Only 1 year, but I thought about this day and night whether I could. And finally, I realized there was a tradition there. Nothing was original, and really everything would depend whether I would have the luck and ability, and also some kind of courage, because it would be suicide, could be suicidal, and failure would be was always in my mind. So I had to accept that as a part of the outcome. In fact, now, still, every book, in a way, it's some kind of failure, because when I began with a lot of a promise, but halfway, and I realized this whole thing fell short of the promise.
I don't think luck had a lot to do with it. You speak English with a Chinese accent.
Sure.
And I wonder if you I wonder if you come across people in the publishing world or maybe early on who like wondered if it was really you writing this amazing English prose.
Oh, I think a lot of non-native speaking writers, they don't speak very well, and they write better. That's both.
Some do.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I think I noticed that the European immigrants Europeans who speak English, they speak more fluently than Asians most of the time, because perhaps the language structures are similar. But I think people with my background, the Chinese, the language is structurally, it's very different, completely different.
No.
So as a result, it's very harder, I think, to speak English very well, like a native, maybe impossible. But on the page, basically, it depends on how much endurance a person has. Stamina, you have to revise and again and again until you are really sick of it. I think even you are sick of it, still you have to continue because you have to have a sense of finish the work. You have to reach that stage. But the truth is after a few weeks, then nothing is finished. You have to do it again. So really endurance is the major part.
You seem to have a lot of endurance. So what about reading? Do you read more in English than in Chinese? Do you read both?
More in English than in Chinese because I teach in the English department and also I write in English. Every book always has a body of books, great books, as kind of a inspiration and a source of energy. So that's why I have to read a lot while I write. Read some books again and again.
Somewhere in the middle of a free life, you have a wonderful throwaway reference to A House for Mr. Biswas by V.S.
Yeah.
Naipaul, one of my favorite writers.
Sure.
Yeah, and a great writer, yeah. So I was curious if... and Naipaul is interesting...
Yes.
I was interested to think about him as an possibly as an inspiration for you. He's obviously someone who has bridged cultures, yeah. If not language. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. The book really that really affected me deeply, profoundly is Abandoning the River.
Yeah.
Really, and when I was for 3 years in a row, I couldn't find a job. I think in the winter of 1992, I was in New York to be interviewed. I carried that novel with me. I was reading that novel. It really changed my perception of the world, and especially the idea of the past, how to deal with one's past. One of the motive, the theme, one of the themes in that book is to the guy Inda, I think he said, you have to trample on the past. And for a person, a Chinese, with my Chinese heritage, the past is a huge, even heavier. It could be easily become baggage. So that book really changed me profoundly.
Is writing in English part of your process of getting away from the baggage or the weight of Chinese tradition?
Not only that. In the beginning, I wasn't sure. I couldn't see the alienation. I couldn't see. I thought my job as a writer was to very simple, to translate history into literature. And I think in the basement of the Yanjing Library at Harvard University, there were so many piles and piles of old magazines and journals, newspapers in Chinese, unclassified. I was very touched by, very moved by that those piles, and I thought my job, my life would be spent writing from history to literature. But as I continued, I realized also I felt a deep alienation from that, and because I think the language itself basically took me away further from my original simple-minded perception of myself as a writer. I think what is important for a writer, one must have a look for kind of a place in a language you use. We don't just use English as an instrument. We have to find a way to bring new things into the language so that we can make some kind of contribution. I think that's what I mean by finding a place for myself as a writer.
Now, are you talking about setting scenes?
No, style, stylistically.
There was one critic who wrote something, I think, about your narrator in War Trash. Mm-hmm. He said the voice of the narrator was unadorned, trusting, and intimate. And when I read that, I thought that was a characteristic of several of your books that I've read, that the narration seemed unadorned, intimate, and trusting. Does that sound on target to you?
Yeah, you know, trustworthy is a virtue because, sure, there are unreliable narrators, but most of the time, if the narrator is trustworthy, it's good because the story can be authentic, at least it can give the illusion for authenticity. And unadorned, and maybe, especially I think in the case of War Trash, the old man, he was an English teacher, but English was not his first language at all. And the whole thing was written by him. So that was a kind of characterized language. It cannot be elaborated at all. So that's why the style was chosen for that. In fact, also slightly formal and stilted because everything was written by him.
How did you have that idea to do it that way? Did that come somewhere in the middle of writing the book, or did you start it that way?
Started that way. That book was heavily influenced by Dostoevsky's Notes of the Dead House. And there are three English translations. I read them all, and I think one of them I read twice. And that book taught me how to write about how to describe this prison life, and how to be patient, chapter by chapter, detail after detail, in order to present the real place and the people. Also, that book is personal. It's a fictionalized memoir. It was published as a memoir, but it's a fictionalized. So I wanted to reverse this a little bit. I want to publish a novel, write a novel in the form of a memoir. So that was, I think that was, at the very beginning, that was the major influence. I was lucky. I really somehow, I just ran into that book many years ago. And so over the years, I read it again and again. So that really shaped.
You mean the Dostoevsky?
Yeah, so shaped my vision for Wall Trash. I'm very lucky. And also, but I decided on that right form, memoir as a form, in as a fiction form. That also means eventually the project can be expanded infinitely, because it's a memoir, autobiography. So whatever is interesting can be put into it, as long as it doesn't upset the unity. So that's why later I did a lot of research. I basically make it richer, and I put in a lot of details from different sources. But if I had planned the whole novel as in a conventional form, tightly plotted, then it would not have had the space for any further information and details.
And how about a free life? Did you start out knowing how you wanted to approach that and structure that?
Yes. And it was really even bigger than it is. Sure, and I thought this was a sizable novel about the immigrant experience, and because I felt this was a very personal subject, and I thought that this would I would give a lot of my life into it. I mean, just spent so many years working on it, and everything and the ending was clear to me. And ninth trip back to China and return, and disillusioned, that was clear. Except the poetry part. Originally, I didn't plan to add the poems. I thought that the extracts from the poetry journal would be enough for an epilogue.
There in the book, for those of you who haven't seen it yet, there are a number, I can't remember how
25
many. 25 poems. 25 poems written by the main character of the book. Mm-hmm. In the back, which is wonderful. They're good poems. I wonder who wrote them.
So, but after a few drafts, I realized if I didn't add the poems, and now would appear like a madman, and because I had to show that he had talent, and his talent was stunted by the immigrant process. He was diminished completely, and so. That would give would make more sense if I added some poems, but there was a bigger disadvantage for that because people could easily associate this novel to Dr. Zhivago structurally. In fact, a number of critics had already pointed that out, and so that. But at the same time, there was no way for me to cut corners. I had to do an honest job. In fact, those poems took me forever to finish. It's very difficult to write.
You were still writing the poems after you finished writing the novel?
I haven't, but I think I will. But poetry is different. Poetry, I think, in a way, it seems poetry depends on luck. A poem really strikes you, and then you have the impulse, and you have a good poem. If a poem is not conceived strongly, no matter how hard you work on it, very often it may not be a strong poem. So in other words, you kind of force a poem into life. It's different from fiction. So I think I'm still waiting.
Waiting, get it? Is it really luck, or is it letting those poems come out of your unconscious?
I you know, what I said was partially true. For instance, the poems I added to Free Life, that was not luck, because I had to write those poems in response to the novel, to the story in the book. So it was really sheer stubbornness, just to force myself to work on the poems. I think a lot of poets, especially in, published poets, a lot of poets, they work very hard, and very often purely by their willpower, they can make a poem work wonder. So that happens. That happens. At the same time, there is a theory, for instance, the great poet Milosh, he said poetry should be written rarely and reluctantly. I do believe in that. I think as if you have a certain amount of energy for peace work, you have to really be careful. You can't just squander everything.
Reluctantly, but with great endurance. Yeah. Talk about some of your favorite poets that have inspired you.
You know, I grew up in fact, with Chinese poetry, and the traditional Chinese poets like Li Bai and Du Fu, and I love their poetry very much. Also, there is a poet of the Song Dynasty, Xin Ji Ji. I think he's a great poet too. In other words, in Chinese poetry, there's a genre or tradition called robust poetry, and I like that kind of poetry. In English, there are a lot, so many. I love Yeats and early Auden and late Yeats and Robert Frost, contemporary poets, Louis Glick, and Andrew Rich, and some of Mark Strand. I think early book, one called Darker, I think it's really a brilliant book. My teacher, Frank Bidard, I like his work very much too. And so there are a lot. Derek Walker, Seamus Heaney, all these great poets. And I mentioned this because they used to live in Boston. When I was a graduate student, they were just regular guy. Seamus basically had a beer in the square, and people talked to him. He was not that, you know, not a really famous poet, seems to me, at the time.
Well, I think your poetry infuses this book in that there are many places where in a short paragraph you will use some imagery that just captures a mood or a place or a scene in a really wonderful way. And it's one of the book's strengths. It's not a question, just an observation. But if I can go back to something we were talking about a moment ago, you were talking about the burden of Chinese literature, and I often wondered as a big reader living in China for many years, I often felt frustrated by how few great Chinese writers are translated, and I felt I wondered if it's at least in part because so many modern Chinese writers labor under this great burden of the tradition of Chinese literature.
Sure, and that's why I think the tradition is so heavy, so big. It's very, very easy to be overshadowed by that. But I think among fiction writers, there's a clear division. There are people like Jin Yong, some others, who write the conventional, the folk fiction or conventional Chinese fiction. Originally, the fiction was performed, basically. But most of the literary writers, I think they write fiction in the Western form. And I think maybe many writers are still struggling with this problem, to what degree they want to be Chinese, or should they just learn from Western writers and just produce whatever they could that way. I think the Japanese perhaps the Japanese writers, now I think they have already, they have done this already. Some modern Japanese writers, apparently, they did not hesitate about learning from the West. Basically, they learned very carefully and meticulously. They mastered all the techniques of Western fiction from the French literature and English literature.
Murakami, maybe?
He learns from American literature. Ando, for Susaku Ando, from French literature. They were very, in other words, they worked very hard just to learn, but I think they have finished the process of apprenticeship already. Some of them have become masters. I think the Chinese writers have not gone through that process. And the reason I put it this way because I feel that literature does not belong to a single nation. It belongs to humanity. No matter where you are from, or which country, or what language you work in, we have to know what is the best in this art produced by humankind. And we must try to write, to work towards that goal, to match it and surpass it. And so I think the Japanese, they managed that. And there are a number of great writers. They produce great work. And I think that the Chinese writers somehow, especially after the communists came to power, a lot of writers, they stopped, basically, their creative career in the prime of their creative years. They couldn't continue. That was a huge loss. As a result, the younger generation, they haven't reached their peak yet. So that's my assessment of the situation.
I read somewhere in an interview of you where you described how when you were in the army and when you first started going to college that you were practically illiterate, which I think was probably an exaggeration. Did you grow up reading Chinese at home?
My father owned a lot of books, but I think when I was 10, and that was the first year for the Cultural Revolution, and all the people in the neighborhood, all the families, basically we had to surrender all the books, and they were burned in a bonfire in the middle of a courtyard. But I didn't know what this meant. I really didn't know. I was too young. I couldn't read at the time. And then later
at age 10?
I could read some textbooks, but my father owned a lot of big books, a lot of classics, in fact. And so I couldn't read those books. So I didn't know, in what way they were valuable. But later when I went to the army, I could read some. We are supposed to read books written by Chairman Mao. We have, in addition to the quotation, small book,
little
charter book. Yeah, also each soldier have a volume of selected works of Mao Zedong. So those books we did read. But I remember clearly in the year 1971, that was the first time I tried to read a book, San Guo Yan Yi, the Three Kingdoms. The first page took me 2 hours, because I didn't know the words, a lot of words. But
because it was classical.
Yeah,
Chinese.
Classical. But I went I went beyond that stage rapidly. I grabbed a dictionary, Xinhua Zidi, a small dictionary. I just studied that dictionary. In a few months, I could read everything.
It's sort of like somebody here, picking up the Odyssey in ancient Greek.
Yeah, but then you read a dictionary and then you figure out what...
Endurance. tell me about your... I was curious, I've read references to your decision to stay in the United States, and you described it as you saw what happened at Tiananmen and you decided to stay, but you made it sound simple, and my suspicion is that it was a little more complicated than that. You must have had a lot of different feelings.
Sure, and you know, of course, it was a big shock to me, and also my family took my family, my wife, and I, and our child 4 years to be together, and my son came out immediately after the Tiananmen tragedy. For me, for several weeks, I was in a shock. I couldn't function because I just couldn't believe this would happen. And at the time, I planned to return to China. So everything basically was turned over in my life. And but at the same time, once my son arrived, it was clear for me that he would become an American. I wanted him to become an American because at the time it seemed to me that there was all this kind of violence, bloodshed, suffering for no purpose, gratuitous, as if there was a cycle. A lot of Chinese had to be trapped in it, just couldn't get out of it. So I wanted my son to get out of it. So it was very simple in intuitive kind of thinking at the time. But I wasn't sure about my own life. I didn't know what to do about my own life because mentally I was not prepared to stay, to live in this country. But gradually, it took me a year to decide, to figure out that there was a tradition, writers who became an important part of the language. If I try, there might be a way there. So that's how gradually I decided to write only in English.
So your decision to write only in English is somehow linked to your decision to become an American?
Yes, it's because my dissertation was aimed at the Chinese job market. That meant I couldn't find a regular teaching position here. And that's why I went to Boston University to learn how to write fiction, basically just to bide my time.
Amazing. I have to tell you, I didn't know anything about A Free Life when I picked it up and started reading. And when it begins, and it's about this man who's come to be a graduate student in the States. And
yes.
I was 5 or 10 pages in, and I thought, oh my God, this is his story. He's telling us his story now. And it just propelled me on. And for those of you who have not read this book yet, you've got a treat waiting for you. But I think for me, part of what was propelling me reading was when you're describing this character who's a restaurant owner who wants to be a poet. It's so charming. And yet, you know, I knew that he was going to succeed as a writer. And I wanted to see how is he going to get there? More to do with endurance than luck, I think.
But I don't know whether he will succeed. But I think failure was clear. You know, I think what is essential here was despite all the frustration, all the loss, he became a better man. I think that's very important. After a decade, he returned in terms of material success. He was similar in a way, but now he was free to make his own decision, and he knew the consequences, and was willing to pay for the price. So in that sense, he's much better. Also, I think he really loves his wife. I think that's important. In that sense, it is also a coming of age story. But it's not totally autobiographical. For instance, I never drop out of graduate school. I never live in New York. I never work in a Chinese restaurant. I always work in American Italian restaurants. And I never returned to China. So the big story is really is not mine. I had a much more fortunate life. I'm much more fortunate than the protagonist. His life is closer to an ordinary immigrant.
I think we're ready to take some questions. So raise your hand, and there's someone with a microphone whose name I've forgotten, sorry. Yes, sure. Microphone is coming.
I'm just curious to know if your work has been translated into Chinese and if you have a Chinese readership.
And they have all my fiction books, I think 7 of them, except the new one, have been translated into Chinese, published in Taiwan. I think they are well received outside China. In China, Waiting was published, then went out of print briefly, and the other books are not published at all, and basically they are banned. I have 5 book contracts with the Shanghai publisher, and they announced 3 times last year my books would come out. And what happened was that they sent a milder book of mine under the red flag, a short story collection, to the censorship department as the first try. But that book was shut down, so they had to abandon the whole project. That's the situation.
But are there any pirated copies?
Yeah, there are pirated editions. But I think even the underground publishers, they make a distinction between the really politically sensitive books and the milder books. For instance, they would not print War Trash or The Craze because they're politically they are too sensitive.
Just so you know, a lot of books in China get banned, and then are available on every street corner because if they're commercially viable, as long as they're not extremely the very politically sensitive ones get banned. Over here on the end corner, wait for the microphone. Here it comes.
This is a comment. This is mainly a comment on this question. Someone from Shanghai that I met. Mm-hmm. A few months ago, I had read Waiting, mm-hmm. where they were living in Singapore, mm-hmm. and it reinforced their notion that living in China was like living in a matrix, the matrix from the movie.
Thank you.
So that you know, Chinese people who can read you, you help them.
I think so, because when I work on a book set in China, I always held the translatability as a principle. That means if the book is translated back into Chinese, the Chinese readers would read and believe it was truthful. That was my principle. But in this case, A Free Life, I think it's very hard for people in mainland China to understand. Very hard. It's an American book. In fact, it really echo the American immigrant literary tradition. Really, a lot of American books are more important as influences. Willa Cather, Harry Roth, and Nabokov.
But I think there are a lot of readers in China who will be fascinated by the Chinese American immigrant
story. Sure. If they think hard and be careful and not just follow others' opinions, sure, yes.
Fair enough. Yes, next to the woman who had the last question.
You are an inspiration. I'm writing my first novel, and it's very hard following. You mentioned plants in doing your research.
Yes.
You can smell cherry blossoms on almost every page in your novels. Was this from your childhood in the country, or do you just love nature? I mean, it's your books are suffused with life and nature. How does that come by? Do you have a garden now? I mean,
no, I grew up in the countryside. For me, I really knew the Chinese countryside, the northeastern countryside life very well, intimately. But I think it's not just my personal taste or sensibility. You know, Terry James used the phrase material sensation. You know, words should have on the page, words on the page should give the kind of sensation, material sensation. And in other words, the texture of life. So that's why we should, as a writer, I think we should try to capture all the details that can reveal the character's life, inner life, and the quality of their daily life. And I do believe that is essential. I think that's why Nabokov said, caress your detail, the divine detail. And I think that's very important to have marvelous details that will substantiate a book, make a book different.
So caress your details. Yes.
You were mentioning how difficult it was to write those poems in the book. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could comment on Nan's idea, his frustration that he felt he needed that woman, his lost love in childhood, that he needed a muse, that part of the reason he couldn't write this poem,
sure.
He didn't have this big love affair to write about.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Sure, but he was silly at the time, right? He was still silly, and he thought it's sure. And in literary history, you have a lot of women who inspired or possessed the poets, and basically heard the poets into song. And he thought if he could have found a woman like that, he would write like a devil, and it was silly, very silly, and in fact, but later, you know, there was a long trip, and after the long trip, finally he met a woman, he realized the whole thing was an illusion, and I think toward the end, he wrote the first love poem for his wife. I think that was a genuine expression of his deep feelings, also a lot of regret as well. And I think a lot of the poems at the end, in fact, reflect his later work. And so that means he did find his inspiration in his loneliness and isolation.
Yes. Please wait for the microphone. It's coming. Okay, sorry.
There are two pieces of the question. They're not really connected. I heard from someone that in writing War Trash, mm-hmm. you took advantage of many memoirs, including internet blogs, by uh-huh. Korean War veterans, uh-huh. Connecting that book to history in a very direct way. Mm-hmm. And I would like to know if this rumor
sure.
is true.
Sure.
And connected with that, you said at the very beginning that you might like one day to do a historical novel
uh-huh.
set in China. And
yes.
I wondered if you would be willing to share with us what your ideas about that might be.
Okay. You know, I said historical novel doesn't mean I don't have a concrete subject, plan for that. I think the first part of the question, and I use a lot of historical sources, and both in English and in Chinese. And Chinese are basically two categories, sources published in mainland China and sources published by the Nationalist Army in Taiwan. And most of the time, there are a lot of memoirs, few pages long, but they are not connected. My job as a writer was to really find the details and unify all these fragments. And I gave a bibliography at the end, basically the sources, and to show and where they came from. And some of the events, let me put this way, there are some events that are very limited to two or three people. but they have been written by different sources. So as a result, people may say, you know, this is from my memoir, but basically there are other sources as well. In China, the publication, there is a different category called Shi Liao by Wen Shi Shubansha, that means historical material press. And these memoirs are classified as clearly as historical materials. In other words, it's like documents. They are different from a regular memoir. What happened is that in some cases, because I live here, I did not know some memoirs published in China, but I use different sources. Sometimes the different sources overlap with those memoirs, published memoirs. So people didn't know where they came from. They didn't know that there are other sources. So that's I think that sometimes people argue, you know, and you know, you use my memoir, you didn't credit. That's the situation. But the problem is a lot of events written in another book. So as a result, the two books overlap. So that's the overlapped areas very often and give the illusion that I didn't credit some sources. But whatever I used, I credit.
I think there was a second half to the story, which was what other...
Oh, there are a lot of historical events in China. Let me just give you an example. For instance, in the late 1950s, there is a so-called the anti-rightist movement, Fan Yu, right? Millions of people, intellectuals, the best educated people, suffered from the movement. Thousands of them just perished in remote areas. What happened is that there is not a single piece of literature written on this, not a single piece. And these were the best educated of the Chinese. But a lot of people try to hold conferences and write petitions, but not a single artist really could stay beyond the momentary controversy or momentary needs and just produce a piece of lasting work. I don't mean I want to do it, but I just this is just one example. There are a lot of historical moments or periods like this in Chinese history, blank in art. I mean blank in art. You do have little pieces of memoir, little memoirs, or a book, sometime like an autobiography. But history does not need many of those. Really need a magnificent book recognized as a classic to preserve this suffering and loss in memory. And so as a writer, that's also a way to fight against the historical amnesia.
Oh, someone over here, yes.
I taught in Tiananmen Square the year before. I mean, taught in Beijing for English. And I want to commend you on your fantastic flow of the language. And whereas my question would be, do you think that some of the creativity of writers is put into Chinese cinema? Do you have any comments on cinema in Chinese or Chinese cinema? Creativity?
Sure, I think it has been very popular and a lot of money has gone into it, that's true. And I think there is also confusion in that area. What is really good art? I think even in the top directors may not be clear about that. And I think
I'm sorry, I don't get that. May not be clear about...
About what is real art, good art. And for instance, I think there are big films, I mean, heavily funded films, but they didn't work very well and just wasted money. I think one of the reasons is that there has been not know enough good books, literature, and that can be adapted from which a good movie can be made. I think that could be one of the reasons. I think even Chinese writers, they always trying to look for the good books and the good writers to produce a first step, as a first step, a good script, and then work from there. I think that part was very hard. It's very hard for them. Let's face it, that there is still a harsh censorship, and they have to learn how to tell lies. So it's very hard to produce a piece of a complicated, universal, that kind of piece of art. It's very difficult, very difficult. In fact, the best films like To Live, that is based upon a good novel, really a magnificent novel. And so I think that's how in the long run, money would not really resolve this problem. What happened at this moment, I think, is China economically is strong and has gained a lot of power. So they want to also produce more soft power. That is the culture, how to make the culture, literature, and art also can flourish. But that art and culture are different from economy. And you can't just spend money on it to make it better. Right, you have to have talent, and talent have to be protected by the right policy and the nourishing environment. And so those are absent, I think, at this moment in mainland China.
Interesting thought for Los Angeles, throwing money at making movies doesn't necessarily ensure quality. Louise.
When you were talking about that, what's needed in China today, I was just kind of a rhetorical question, but I was, if you could imagine as a novelist in your lifetime that there would be enough of a change in the government, could you see yourself going back or contributing to cultural policy in China today? I mean, could you even fictionalize that? I mean,
No, I don't think so. You know, I'm just the individual person. What can I do? All I can do have is a personal voice, my job was to give an individual character a convincing personal voice that I can't do anything. And let's face it, I'm 51. You know, I'm too old for a lot of things, and I don't think I can do anything. I don't think
you can write.
That's all I can do, and I work on the page. But sometimes, you know, the influence of writing is very limited. We have to admit that. And so really, I don't see I can do anything. Occasionally, I do write essays and talk about these ideas. But then very often I get attacked because, you know, this is from America, the United States. Very often the people would interpret this as an American voice. They would not take it as a personal voice. That's the trouble.
Yes. Okay.
I'm reading A Free Life, and I'm just fascinated because I can't put it down.
Oh, thank you. I'm flattered.
So I guess my question, I don't know if you can answer it, how do you do that?
Good question.
Work hard. You see the pile of just drafts, piles and piles of drafts. And honestly, at any moment, this book I felt I could have failed at any moment. In fact, last summer in the interview, I said if it's a flop, I hope it will be a great one. and really, it's so hard. Just because it is sizable, and also a lot of things were new to me. When a book is set in China, basically I had kind of privilege. The audience did not know what I was talking about. So my job was not to abuse that privilege. But in this book, everything has to be accurate because there are actual references. So the labor was doubled, at least doubled. So as I said before, pure endurance. And it's not my personal opinion. In fact, Flaubert said, once he was asked, what is talent? He said, a long patience. Talent is a long patience.
Yes.
I'm interested in your statement about speaking as an individual. I think about a minute ago you said that in relation to your essays, particularly since you are an immigrant writer writing in another language. You look at different forms of writing, historic writing, memoir writing, literary writing, and yet there seems to be an advocacy for an individual voice.
Sure.
And perhaps this is something that's related to a previous question. How do you do it? How do you find the individual voice?
Oh, of course, we try to identify with the character. I think you spend more time with the character and then you get to know, like a friend, you know that person much more. I think I learned this in writing Waiting. I was terribly worried about the women characters in that book. So I really pay a lot of attention to them. And after many drafts, I sent the manuscript to my agent. And she read it, she said, all the women characters are fine, the men are too pale. They're flat and pale. Also, then I realized that I didn't pay attention to the men. My mind basically was focused on the women in the book. That showed that the attention, the time you spend with a character, that eventually can make the character to bring out all the nuances and the individuality of that character on the page. And I think also as a literature, I think it should be individual, not just a collective voice. For me, I think the individual voice is more important. When we talk about literature traditionally, often we use two principles. One is permanency and the other is universality. Permanency, basically we don't know how to deal with that. That's time will decide whether something will last. But the universality is something, I think it always starts with the particular. It always situates within a particular. If we don't start with the individual, the particular, you can never reach the universal. So it's better to make a voice individual and personal. As a result, that can be shared by everybody. I think in current Chinese writing, for instance, in the United States as well, there are a lot of memoirs and books. They talk about celebrities and important names. But if you put this into another language, people don't know about these references anymore. On contrast,
so they become meaningless.
Yes, that they don't mean anything to others. But if you just write about an individual, a person, and then it is translatable, it means more to others in different languages, different cultures.
Well, as the person sitting here, I get to exercise my privilege and ask the last question. I read that one of your teachers, Leslie Epstein, was asked by an interviewer, by a journalist about your writing, and he said the best is yet to come. Do you think that's true?
I don't know. He always trusts, have more confidence in me than I have in myself. And as I said, every book is kind of failure. It's hard. It's easy to imagine a great book, but once you begin work on it, that you don't feel that you don't have the ability. So it's hard to say. It's impossible, perhaps.
Well, with failures like these, you're in good shape.
Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.